2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 225, How to Be an Anti-Racist in a Racist Society, a paper presented by Darren T. Smith, with a response by Michael J. Stevens.
Culture and Society, column editor, The Long-Promised Day, Sunstone. Our respondent is Michael J. Stevens, Assistant Professor of Management, University of Missouri at St. Louis, consultant specializing in improving teamwork and interpersonal effectiveness in the workplace. He's a member of the Sunstone Board of Trustees, and he's a former assistant nursery leader. He told me that's the highest office he's held. I said, well, that depends on what your definition of high is. We will begin with Darren.
Yeah, please. Okay. Hello. Welcome to this presentation, and I'm glad to see we have such a large turnout. I'm being funny, by the way. So I'm assuming everyone knows how to be an anti-racist. That's why we have you folks are the ones that are left over, right? As was mentioned, I'm actually a doctoral student at the University of Utah, and my area of emphasis is in race, gender, and class dynamics as it pertains to higher education. I'm concerned and interested in how organizations do the business of race, class, and gender. And so much of this material is going to come from largely from what I've studied in my program, as well as my experience teaching at BYU, although I don't know if I'll still be there after they find out that I've been here. But at any rate, I've been down there for 7 years and have gathered just a wealth of experience working with students at BYU, predominantly white institution, as everyone knows, and it's been interesting. I've had some good experiences there with my students in terms of them getting it. I'm often criticized by colleagues and folks at the University of Utah, and they always ask me, why do you teach down there? They don't care about this material. They don't care about that. And I have to correct them and say that the students are equally as concerned, I believe, at least the small audience that I tend to get every semester. So it is a little bit more daunting teaching adults, simply because adults tend to be more rigid, more inflexible in terms of their belief systems. Whereas young people are a little bit more malleable. And so, especially when we start talking about issues of whiteness and whiteness theory. As you know, the title of this presentation deals with how to become an anti-racist. Well, let me throw this out at you. You can't even begin to be an anti-racist until you understand that there's something out there called racism, and it exists. And it operates at various levels. It's multi-layered. And that's typically the approach that I take teaching these kinds of sessions and classes and so on. Let me just talk briefly just about two, before we get these slides up. I think there's a little button that might be down there. It says A and B on it at the bottom. But there's two ideas that I want to talk about. The first idea is, I mentioned yesterday for those who were in attendance at the session that we had yesterday, this notion of ideological racism. Ideological racism stems from beliefs, values, systems, ideas, perceptions, mores, and so on. That's primarily the mode of operation when we're talking about racism. Most folks are kind of stuck in that mode of race consciousness. Much of what we know, much of what we believe about race stems from a long historical experience of race, clear back in the 1600s. Much of that material, much of that understanding continues today. Its legacy is around. However, race does tend to change at historical moments. It's not going to stay the same. In other words, how race was practiced back in the 1600s looks very different, we hope, than how it's practiced today. So we have made some progress. However, various legacies and ideas and so on continue and remain today. When we talk about race, for instance, one of the things that's very challenging to talk about this topic, particularly to a white audience, is the fact that most white people think they know something about racism. right? We say, well, tell me about racism. Well, I can tell you about racism and, you know, based on my experience. When whites, to a large extent, have not been the recipients of racist practices, right? And if they have, it certainly pales in comparison to those who are certainly people of color. One of the other daunting tasks of teaching these kinds of ideas is that there's a certain amount of resistance, right, that people don't want to hear it. And I actually call it the Camelot syndrome. And what I mean by that is there's this inflexibility and rigidity that is centered around discussing race. And so by talking about race, at least at the ideological level, exposes fallacies and falsities in one's perception of the world, right? That my world and my worldview is intact, right? And what I come to believe is to a large extent truth, right? And I say truth with a small t. So then we start unraveling and unveiling some contradictions in those belief systems. People don't like that very much, right? Things that they have investments in, right? Ideas that they have investments in become challenged and turned upside down. Of course, that causes much anxiety. So if we can go back to that first part, is that there? Okay, great. Is there like a little clicker? Okay. All right. Well, part of this session deals with that. I want to, as soon as we get that up, I can illustrate that. But so most of it stems from the resistance. And thank you. You got it. Wonderful. Okay. And in fact, I think that's it. Okay. That'd be good. If this is an excerpt from an excellent article that was written by Peggy McIntosh. Is anybody familiar with her work in here? Peggy McIntosh wrote an article several years ago called "Unpacking Whiteness," and this is one of the things that she indicates in her essay. She says, "I was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems conferring dominance on my group." Interesting. I think that's an interesting analysis. Go ahead and go to the next slide, please. The next slide. Yes. Okay. This is an actual slogan that's been done by the Native American. Oh, we're gonna rehearse that again. Okay, here we go. Thank you. And this caused a little bit of controversy when the Native Americans adopted this symbol as their mascot. There's various athletic teams in the country, as you know, that use Native American symbols as their mascot. So Native Americans flip the script and say, okay, we're going to use this corporate-minded, you know, white male as our symbol. Everything is going to be all white is what their symbol is. I thought it was kind of funny. And they actually made quite a bit of money off this, by the way. So go ahead and go to the next slide. Next one. That's my daughter. Okay. Go ahead and go to the next one. Okay. This is what Peggy McIntosh says. She says, as a white person, I realized that I'd been taught about racism as something that puts others at a disadvantage, but I had been taught not to see one of its corollary aspects, white privilege, which puts me at an advantage. So she introduces this concept of white privilege. What exactly is white privilege? And how does it get, and how does white privilege become racist practices, right, in the larger superstructure? Go ahead and go to the next one, please. I think whites are carefully taught not to recognize white privilege as males are taught not to recognize male privilege, right? It's only when we get challenged as men about our sexism that we suddenly realize that, hey, our particular orientation is very different from that of women. And it's painful, right? I mean, my wife is reminding me daily of my sexism, right? And it's very painful to me, just because I find ways to mystify it, and I find ways to turn it back on her, right? Make it her problem. But in reality, I'm probably doing some invisible systems of male privilege that I'm not aware of until she brings it to my attention. Women, you have the luxury of knowing that and seeing that because of the gendered body of a female. So she says, I've begun in an untutored way to ask what it's like to have white privilege, and she lists 26 privileges. This is very fascinating. Go ahead and go to the next one. I can, if I wish, arrange to be in company of people of my race most of the time. That's powerful, right? I was watching on CNN last night, and they and there was a little, you know, at the bottom of the screen they have this little, the news keeps flashing, and it said that this, I guess this was supposed to be an epiphany by whoever created that little caption, but it said that American schools are now now resegregated. Okay, tell me something I didn't know. I mean, American schools are definitely much more segregated now than they've ever been. I mean, and the data is replete with that. Most of us coming from Harvard University, there's a professor there who's been doing a lot of studies on this notion of the resegregation of schools. So white people have a choice to live in communities, all white communities, right? Hence, a way to avoid the other, of course, would be to build enclaves, gated enclaves, right? We can keep them out if we gate it up and just have all of our folk up in there, and we put a guard at the front. Right, we can keep them out. So before we had suburbs, which was one way to escape the other, and now we have, of course, gated communities. So this is a choice. This, to a large extent, this is a choice and a privilege, according to Peggy McIntosh. Next. If I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing housing in an area that I can afford and in which I want to live. So she's talking about the class privilege here, right, of being middle class and having that opportunity to move and be mobile. The next one, please. I can be pretty sure that my neighbors in such locations will be neutral or pleasant to me, right? So even if I quote a middle class male move into an area, I can't always be sure that I'm going to be received, right? At least in a neutral way, right? At least certainly my race is not going to be a factor in that community. Okay. This is really interesting. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. Now, how often does that happen? I can tell you experiences after experiences in this state where I've gone into stores and I've just kind of looked around and recognized that, hey, I'm being trailed by folks, right? Particularly when I'm wearing my urban getup, right? So when I'm wearing my urban getup, I'm much more of a target, right? And so yeah, this happens a lot, and I consider myself a highly educated individual, but it still happens. I can turn on the television and front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. Last night I couldn't get any sleep, so I woke up my wife was up too, and so we started talking. And I said, let's just watch the news and see if they have anything on there that, other than, you know, white themes and norms and values. And sure enough, virtually everything on the news was precisely what we had anticipated. But this is a very powerful symbol, right? When people of color turn the TV on and look for other people of color, they don't see other people of color. There was a study that was done that looked at who are the likeliest individuals to watch UPN. You've heard of UPN, right? It's predominantly African American in terms of its programming, right? The conclusion was that, of course, white people are going to watch UPN, because there's more white people in America than there is people of color, at least African Americans, that particular population. And just the opposite. More African Americans watched UPN than they did the standard programming. Should it surprise anybody that African Americans are starved? They want to see themselves represented. And they would rather see themselves represented in a negative way than not to see themselves represented at all on TV. Interesting. Interesting study. Go ahead. Thank you. When I'm told about our national heritage or about civilization, I'm shown that people of my color made it what it is. Wow, that's heavy. Next. I can be pretty sure that my children will be given curricular materials that testify to their existence, to the existence of their race. Interesting. And I like how Peggy McIntosh is using the word race. She's using the word race. She's saying that white people have a race too. So it's not just about African Americans or Latinos or other groups having a race, but whites have a race as well. Please. If I want, I can be pretty sure of finding a publisher for this piece on white privilege. That's even more interesting, yes. And I can go into a music store, count on finding music of my race widely represented in the supermarket, or find a staple foods that fit my cultural traditions into a hairdresser shop and find someone who can deal with my hair, right? So having said that, of course, you know that's why I cut mine down. So, okay. Sorry. Whether I use checks, credit cards, cash, I can count my skin color not working against me in the appearance of financial reliability. And then the next one. I can arrange to protect my children most of the time from people who might not like them. Okay. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to bad morals, the poverty, or the literacy of my race. Okay? I can speak in public to a powerful male group without putting my race on trial. How many times have you heard somebody say, so Jim, tell me about the white race? How often does that happen? But I hear it so often the other way. So Darren, tell me the black perspective, as if my perspective is representative of all African Americans. What African Americans share in common? First of all, there's no single monolithic African American people. It's regional, it's geographical. What people of color do share in common is oppression, right? Is being oppressed. Other than that, there's vast differences in consciousness and that's, of course, situation and location, okay? And then she says, you know, I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. I'm never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group, okay? I can remain oblivious of the language and customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling, in my culture, any penalty for such oblivion, right? She goes on to say, I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behaviors without being seen as a cultural outsider. And then she goes, I can be sure that if I'm asked to talk to a person in charge, I'll be facing a person of my race. That's tremendous there. If a traffic cop pulls me over or if the IRS audits my tax return, I can be pretty sure I haven't been singled out because of my race. And she goes on, and of course, the very bottom, and this is something that's even so subtle, but yet so powerful. I can choose blemish cover or Band-Aids in flesh color that more or less matches my skin. It's even that subtle in terms of the racial dynamics, right? Next. Okay, we're going to do that again. All right, next. Oh, again, okay. Next. Okay, this is a little bit of information that deals with some of the racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. I'm actually a physician assistant, so part of my training is to treat patients and see patients. And this is some of the material disadvantages of race as it's outlined by Ronald Roach. And we don't have time to get into that, but there's been data compiled on this whole issue of race and healthcare disparities. Yes. This is a breakdown of the AIDS crisis and how that is impacted disproportionately on people of color. Right, right now, one of the highest rate of AIDS, the AIDS epidemic, is impacting black females. Right, next. Okay, and this is some themes to consider in terms of the whiteness literature. Go ahead and next one. Listening. This whole idea of listening. Right, the fact that when one of the personal relational constraints of whiteness theory, at least in terms of how whiteness scholars argue, is that white people have a really tough time of listening, particularly when it comes to other people's voices. See, it's much easier to listen to someone who's white, but much much harder to listen to someone who's not white, right? Because of those barriers that go up, these subconscious, subliminal kinds of messages that are implanted, and they're ingrained, and they're unintentional, and they're there, and they've not been criticized or critiqued in any significant manner. Yes, exactly. Listening across racial boundaries. Next. Being a good person. This is huge. Okay? So being a good person, of course, would be the notion that if I question or self-criticize my belief systems and discover that, yes, I do harbor racial ideology, I'm no longer a good person. Right? This has huge implications in terms of being an anti-racist. Okay? Innocence and blamelessness. Right? Next. Niceness. Politeness. Right? Next. Exceptionalism. So in other words, this is an interesting one because what this one speaks to is the fact that they're not all like them, right? Them, I mean, those people in the hood that wear the gold chains and the gold teeth and so on. They're not all like them, but, you know, there's a couple of good ones out there like me, right? So I'm an exception. So next. Of course, the notorious colorblindness, that we're all colorblind, and we know we're not colorblind. Are we all genderblind? Probably not, right? We recognize that. But the discourse of colorblindness is huge and deeply ingrained. Yes? Analogous thinking, and then the last one, benevolence. Okay? And here's some of the institutional themes of whiteness. Next one, authority, right? When we look at authority of people who are put in authoritative positions, typically it's going to be someone that looks like you folks, rather than someone who looks like me, right? I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but it's disproportionate, right? merit, the notion of merit, right? That I got where I am because I'm the bomb, right? That I worked hard, and you probably did work hard, but you didn't have race working against you, right? Race wasn't a factor. So the notion of merit is turned upside down when you look at how race impacts this idea of merit, which is deeply ingrained, right? The Protestant work ethic, right? The harder you work, the more you get. So why is it that different racial and ethnic groups in America who've had quote equal access to opportunity still lag behind? Is it because they're all lazy? Is it because they all don't want to work? They don't have that work ethic? Or is there something else going on here, right? Yes, yes. Of course, this whole notion of goodness next, expertise, right? And what's interesting about this one is that when during the riots in '92, most of the news broadcasting companies were interviewing white scholars, asking them about what's happening in Watts and Compton and so on. And very rarely did you hear a voice of color talking about the experience, right? It was just assumed that the white males and females who were interviewed knew more about that experience than those individuals who were participating in it or who've done research in that area, right? Interesting, the whole notion of expertise. Okay, for instance, let me give you another example of that. This would probably go over better if a white person was talking than a person of color. Because if I'm talking, I have an axe to grind, right? I'm invested in this, right? This is political for me, right? So this is exactly how it gets implicated in terms of real-world practices. Of course, legitimacy is another thing in terms of if the face was different, but the presentation was the same. There's an air of legitimacy here. Okay, objectivity, the notion of being objective, removing oneself from the experience. Right? I can't possibly talk objectively about this topic because I'm invested in it. Right? So. Of course, neutrality, the notion of neutrality, all of these are themes, institutional themes. So being neutral assumes, once again, this whole colorblindness idea. And then, of course, one size fits all, that knowledge and policies and methods are ubiquitous, that everyone benefits equally, right? Not considering one's ethnicity or one's race or one's gender even, okay? And, of course, these are all designed to be fair, right? Okay. And of course, the material themes would be this: safety, notions of safety, violence, health. So, in other words, there's a material consequence to being raced, right? I mean, we know that people of color die on average sooner than whites, right? Given the same access to health care, given the same medicines, the same, assuming the same opportunities, right, for healthcare, but yet the death rate reflects the fact that there's something going on, and we don't want to talk about that. What's happening here at an institutional level? Okay, property, opportunity, policing, surveillance, and fear. Okay, and exploitation. Here's some interesting data that I want to show you that really crystallizes the differences in experience. Average months of white prisoners served for crime on average is about 24 months. Black prisoners for the same crime about 26 months. Average number of months white prisoners served for rape was 56 months. Average for blacks, 70 months. Right? So there's something different about black folks with this. And it could stem from the historical notions of black male sexuality, right? That black men are much more promiscuous than white males, right? And so therefore, this is going to be reflected in of course, crime and punishment. A percent of drivers on interstate who are black, 20% of drivers pull over and searched on I-95, which is a strip of highway on the East Coast, who are black, 70. Number of black men disenfranchised in 1998 because of felony convictions, 1.4 million. Total percentage of black male voting age population disenfranchised, 13%. So we can't get people elected because most of them are locked up. Okay. Okay. This is interesting. If you want to see the real disparities in race in terms of African Americans. Look at the financial implication here. It's amazing. Amount black households earn for every dollar earned by white households, 62 cents on the dollar. Medium net worth of a white family is $45,000, roughly. Medium worth of a black family, $4,000. Right? Medium net financial assets, net worth minus home and car equity per white family, $7,000. Medium net financial assets for black family is zero. Right? So the aggregate wealth there. In fact, what's interesting is that when you Cornel West wrote a book and talks about some of the data, that the aggregate wealth of blacks post-emancipation was 0.5%. Okay, 0.5%. Some 150 years later, the aggregate wealth of blacks as a group is 1%. So it hasn't gone up a whole lot since emancipation.
Double.
Yeah. So I wish that was reflected in my income. Black-white gap in wealth accumulation in 67 was 16,000. In 88 was 72,000. Average mortgage rate for black homeowners is 9.6%. Average for whites, 0.7%. Extra amount that black homeowners pay the banks, $10.5 billion. That's this extra in interest. Price of being black for this generation, totaling higher mortgages of $82 billion. So you pay a little bit more because you're black, right? You're going to pay a little bit more. In fact, there was another study that came out that indicated that if a person of color wants to buy a car, do it on the internet because you're going to pay on average $2,000 or $3,000 more from a car dealer. And so projected price of being black for the next generation is $93 billion. Okay, average advantage of being white for the next generation is $93 billion. Okay, and here's some of the material. Issues. Infant mortality rate for blacks in 1994 was 15.8, for whites was 6.6. So this is the highest in the world, folks. The highest in the world, and no one seems to know why. Right? Why? And this even cuts across class privilege, that the infant mortality rate is still exorbitantly high. Maternal mortality rate, deaths per thousand for black women in 1990 was 22.4, and 80 was 21.5. Material mortality rate for white women in 90 was 5.4, in 1980, 6.7. That's right. Cancer rates for black men every year per 100,000 is 557.2 cases. Cancer rate for white men is 464.0. Cancer rates for white women, 348. Rates for black, 331. Life expectancy for black females in years as of 95 was 74. White females in 95 was 80. For black males in 95 was 64.8. For men, 73.6. Percent of American population that is black is currently 13%. Percentage of American population with AIDS who are black is 45%. So there's more black people with AIDS than without. But there's a problem here, right? And so the question is this a function of people making poor choices? I mean, can we reasonably explain that this is a function of that entirely? Does that entirely explain this picture? Okay. And then here's another interesting stat. Number of black students admitted to University of Texas Law School in 96 was 65. Number of black students admitted to University of Texas after the affirmative action was abolished, 11. A percentage of first-time, full-time freshmen who are black at Tennessee colleges in 76 was 22.3. In 96 was 17.7. Percentage of white college and high school age students with access to home computers, 73%. For blacks, 32%. Bachelor's degrees, 97. Percentage of whites was 29%. For blacks was 14%. The vast majority of those who are in higher education find themselves at junior colleges. Okay, that's where most African Americans and Latinos go to school and get degrees. And those are terminal degrees, as you know. So there's a tracking system going on even in higher education. Medium income for native-born ethnic Cuban Americans in 90, $37,000. For Irish Americans in 90, $38,000. Medium income for native-born Polish Americans, $41,000. Mexican Americans, $26,000. African Americans, $20,000. So even after the length of time that African Americans have been in this country, there's huge disparities here in terms of wealth and aggregate wealth and mobility and so on. And but there's the other side of this that some scholars would argue, well, there's an increase in the black middle class. It's around 20%, 30%, depending on who you ask and who you read. I happen to believe it's a little less than that, probably about 20% of blacks who benefited from the early affirmative action implementation post-64 were recipients of this and have, of course, perpetuated, hopefully, the class privilege. But to a large extent, the vast majority of blacks are still struggling, are still, quote, working class folks. Go ahead. Thank you. And then, of course, I love these. These are excellent. Groups most likely to be strip searched or x-rayed by U.S. Customs officials from returning from overseas, black women. Okay. Groups least likely to be found carrying illegal drugs returning from overseas, black women. Percentage of black residents in metropolitan areas who have a white neighbor, 29 in 90. Percentage of white residents in metropolitan area that have black neighbors, 5%. Look at how just way disproportionate. So how many of you live around a neighbor of color? Raise your hand. Okay. Black-white unemployment rate for 25 to 64 years old in 50 was 1.864% black, 6.4% black and 3.8 white. In 95, that rate was 1.8, 7.2 black, 3.8 white. Math mean score, the mean math SAT score for black students with family incomes of 70,000 or more in 95 was 442. The mean math score for white families with an income of 10,000 or less was 460. Now, what's this data reveal? What is it talking about in terms of what counts as knowledge, right? And who gets to do the counting? So even with knowledge construction, there is a privileging of certain ideas and concepts, right? That even poor white children are getting, that even kids of African or Latino descent still are not getting the same quality of education that other students are getting, which is to me is astounding. And as an educator, this is something that I'm extremely interested in. Look at the death rates here. So this is interesting. White females, most of us are going to die from heart disease because we like to eat greasy food. Okay, most of the liver will make most of the cholesterol you will ever need. Your liver will. So if you never ate anything with cholesterol in it, you'd be fine. Your liver would make it. But we want to eat a lot of exogenous cholesterol from various foods, you know, and that's one of the issues. But the death rate from cardiovascular disease is 42.5% for white females. For black females, 40.8. Cancer, look at the differences there. And just kind of skim that over real quick and look at the differences there. They're quite interesting. But these are the top five, the top four killers. And, of course, it's going to look differently for different groups. So, for instance, look at the black males, Hispanic male category. You got cancer. You've got accidents. You've got homicide, 4.3%. AIDS, 3.8%. And you look at the white male category. You see some things on there, but you don't see things on there. Diabetes mellitus, being another one. Hispanic males, you see cancer, accidents, homicide, diabetes mellitus. Pacific Islanders, you see cancer, accidents, chronic lower respiratory disease, diabetes mellitus. I had a colleague that went over to American Samoa and said that the incidence of diabetes there was unbelievable. The amount of amputees that she saw in that part of the world was amazing. Of course, you got Indian, Alaskan natives, females and males. The differences there. You see even the cirrhosis of the liver. You see that turn up in terms of homicide, in terms of the death rate for that population. Okay. And here's the discursive themes. And Mike and I kind of spoke about this yesterday. And this whole notion of artifacts. The discursive notions would be, of course, exoticism, universalism, intelligibility, relevance, threat, dualisms, and this is probably one of the most interesting areas of study would be this notion of binaries, right? When we talk about race dynamics in American society, we always revert to the black and white binary, right? You watch TV, you see commercials of other people on TV, it's almost always going to be a black person, an African American, right? That represents this binary, and clearly this is more of there's more representations of difference in America than just black and white. But that's the predominant binary. There's the us and them. Here's an example of that. Yesterday during the session, And the us and them is ordered, it's hierarchical, right, which means that one is better than the other. This is what's interesting about binaries, but one of the participants stood up and asked the question. He says, well, could you tell me about your people, how your people, do this, or your people? It was innocent enough, but your people assumes there's an underlying assumption there. And this is what I meant when I mentioned earlier, folks, about how innocent and unintentional this is, right? But to someone who's quote, conscious of this, it means something. The notion of right and wrong, laziness, ambition, right? So these people, the African-American community and the Latino community and other communities of color who are not doing well, it's usually attributed to laziness, lack of ambition, lack of opportunity, lack of whatever. It's typically relegated to an idea of deficiency. These are deficiencies within individuals rather than structures that these systems of the conferring privilege confer upon different groups have to do with the material outcomes of individuals and groups, primitivism, and of course the manipulation of symbols. And then universalism means it's the same idea that the one size fits all policy, right? That policies that are created and methods that are created are meant to be universal for everyone, right? That race is not considered in that. Gender is not considered in that. Let's go ahead and skip forward. Okay, so of course then we look at this notion that whiteness theory treats whiteness not as a biological category but as a social construction, and as far as whiteness is thought to be as natural, is understood in essentialized terms, either as a personal attribute or a scientific category. Who gets to count as white depends on what is at stake. Critical race theory, which is a theoretical framework, would argue the notion of interest convergence. In other words, white people will tolerate advances for people of color only if it benefits whites. Right? So whites are benefiting from it, then of course they'll tolerate that. And some of the recent literature that came out by a paper that was presented a couple of years ago by a scholar by the name of Geichtal indicated that affirmative action wasn't really benefiting people of color. The data reveal that it's benefiting white women much more than it is people of color, which is interesting to me. But so then, how do we get to a point? That's enough there. Thank you. How do we get to a point to where we can become anti-racist, folks? In order to become anti-racist, at least at some operational level, means that we have to self-critique, look inward at our own discourses, right? Uncriticized discourses to find out where the loopholes are. Let me give you an example. If you're walking down the street and you see some young men of color approaching you, what runs through your mind? Those are the kind of things that I'm talking about. The fact that, at least in terms of, at least on the individual level, right? Because obviously, it's going to take a nation of critically conscious folks to change the landscape of the kind of situation we're talking about. What's interesting to me is when I look at least in terms of LDS discourse, when we look at this idea of loving our neighbors as ourselves, right? I want to go there just for one brief moment. On any given day in the LDS church, in any given Sunday, you'll hear someone up on the podium saying, and I love my neighbor as myself, okay? What exactly does that mean? Does that mean that we love our neighbors as ourselves who happen to be middle class and who look like us, who live in the same communities that we live in? Is that what that means? To me, that's going to be a different kind of love than loving across racial boundaries, right? And to get to a point where we love across racial boundaries, to me seems like we've got to put ourselves at risk and take risks and go out and try to develop friendships and experiences that may be foreign to us in many ways, may be very foreign to us, and maybe to a large extent dangerous, right? In the sense that we're putting ourselves at risk emotionally. Primarily. Let me give you a quick example of that. My wife did not want my daughter to go stay with my mother in L.A. My mother lives in kind of the hood, right? And so my wife said, well, I don't want her to go there. And I said, well, why don't you want her to go there? She goes, well, I just don't like the way that your mother, takes care of her. Okay, so what do you mean? Let's get to the heart of this matter. So as it turns out, she had a conception that my mother's experience was less than her experience. Basically to sum it up, right? Notwithstanding, my mother's an excellent, provider, does a great job. That's a kind of a plug for my mom. But even more so, trying to get my wife to recognize how these invisible systems confer upon her ways of knowing, knowledge production, right, that are typically ordered. So by saying, I don't want Keisha going with your mom, creates a binary and creates an ordered way of thinking, that one way is good and one way is bad. There can't be any gray areas or areas of radical possibilities, right? So if you're looking for answers today, and this is my segue, if you want me to tell you this is how you become anti-racist. Step one, you do this. Step two, I can't tell you that. It's so much more complex than that. And each of you are at your own different levels of consciousness in terms of where you are with being anti-racist. But in terms of how we get to a place where we can love across racial boundaries, to me, means that we go, at least to some extent, we can look at the scriptures for some example of that. And in brief, Jesus Christ spent time with the woman at the well, Jacob's well, right? We know that he went into Samaria. He spent 2 days in Samaria. He emerged from Samaria after 2 days, and we know that he was doing something there. He was teaching, preaching, getting to know folks on a much deeper level, to come out of that experience only to be ridiculed and criticized by his own people, right, because the Jews and the Samaritans had no dealings with one another. So it seems to me that, to, at least at some level, to be able to become anti-racist, anti-ethnic, anti-sexist means that you begin to question the one-minute discourse that is so deeply embedded in the ways that we become to know, or at least question, or at least the ways that we become, the ways that we know what we know, the ways that we assume what we assume. Let me give you just one last example of that. What whites know about race pales in comparison to what people of color know. And we know this because of the research that's been done by W.E.B. Du Bois and other scholars of color who've written so eloquently about this idea of double consciousness, right? That whites don't have, whites have the privilege of ignoring race, because it doesn't impact on your life in any significant way. So it seems to me, in order to become anti-racist, you've got to kind of immerse yourself in a racial experience, right, in order to get to that point. And then lastly, I'll say that should lead you towards some critical inquiry in terms of where the deficiencies are, where the stereotypes are, where the hang-ups are that prevent us from being the kind of folk that we claim that we are. Because most of the stuff is it's hypocrisy big time in terms of this notion of democracy and so on and so forth. So it seems to me that until we can get to that point as citizens of the Republic, as individuals, and some of you as Christians, we're going to have to begin to question our own belief systems. And until we do that, I think we'll continue to have these kinds of vexing problems of race, class, and gender. So I hope that gave you some indication, at least some idea of these very, very difficult issues. Thank you for your time.
Well, I've just got a few points of follow-up that I wanted to add. I wanted to start, first of all, with a question. See if anybody in here knows the answer. How many anti-racism educators does it take to change a light bulb? The answer, of course, is only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. One of the premises that I used to approach is the idea that there is an innate, universal human tendency to have a closed heart towards those who are different from us. I don't have any scientific proof to back up that claim. It's just been my own experience and my own introspection as to my own journey. Why is this the case? I don't know. I have some speculative hypotheses about why that's. One has to do with socio and psychological discomfort issues. Some of it has to do with personality predispositions. Some of us are more open to experience than others. Some of us have personality styles that are more comfortable with routine and habituation. Another possible hypothesis could be a biological or an evolutionary explanation. You've all heard the aphorism that curiosity killed the cat. Well, you know, if you go back thousands of years to our evolutionary progenitors, curiosity probably killed early Homo sapiens, too. And lo and behold, the more curious amongst our our evolutionary ancestors who went off and explored things they didn't know were dangerous, they died off, and so did that trait of curiosity. And so many of us, I think, have evolved to a point where it's just safer. It's more predictable to stay with what we know, to stay with routine, and that may also be why this innate universal human tendency to be closed off is so universal. Be that as it may, I am absolutely convinced there's hope. However, there is one other difficulty, and that's my second premise, and that is as human beings, we all tend to develop mythologies around our views that justify how we are right in having these closed hearts and negative attitudes. Now, when I use the word mythologies within the broader context as a professor at a public university or when I work with businesses in corporate training, other kinds of arrangements, we can pretty much leave it there. When we deal with that question in Mormonism, there is an immediate roadblock because people within the church and gospel tradition say, well, wait a minute, we don't have mythologies. We have doctrine. And if you begin to suggest that maybe we develop doctrines around our views that justify how we are right in having these closed hearts and negative attitudes, there's an immediate disconnect. And you know, if you're black or woman and you raise feminist issues, things of that nature, you are a rabble-rouser, you are unfaithful. Those are some of the most dangerous questions that only apostates would ask. How can you even go there? If you are a temple recommend carrying high priest and you raise those questions in, you know, your priesthood meetings or gospel doctrine class, well, you're bleeding heart liberal, and you know, how could you capitulate and go over to the enemy like that? We know you have a recommend because you're there at the, you know, temple on war temple nights, but you know, they look at you with suspicion. So those are issues we've got to deal with as well. I didn't know we were going to have a multimedia presentation slide, or I would have brought one of my favorite PowerPoint slides to help clarify the kinds of things that I'm talking about here. But in any event, I can describe it briefly. That is a PowerPoint slide that has a picture of an iceberg. Okay? And with an iceberg, 90% of it's below the surface, 10% is floating above. The 10% is what you see. All the stuff underneath the surface holds up that 10%. Now, when we're talking about culture in any kind of an organization, the 10% that you see are what we call cultural artifacts. Cultural artifacts are things like the rules and the policies and procedures that you have in that organization. That's the embodiment of the underlying ideology, the values that hold up that culture. The rules, policies, procedures, the way in which physical space is used, the jargon, the language, the heroic stories and legends, okay? Those are all things you can objectively see, measure, weigh, count, and so on. Now, the thing that holds those artifacts up, though, are very deeply held and are beneath the surface and operate so deeply for most of us, we're not even aware that they're there. Now, those deeper subconscious sorts of things, underlying values, beliefs, assumptions, mental models, and worldviews. Now, when you start mucking around with those underlying values and beliefs and mental models, that's where people start to get very, very uncomfortable and have this real serious disconnect. I can suggest a couple of things real quickly for broaching that barrier that we have to make this disconnect, to show how rules, policies, procedures, language, acts, you know, all these cultural artifacts are rooted, when we talk about racism, they're rooted in race ideology. When we talk about sexism, it's the exact same sort of a thing, you know. There's a difference between gender and sex, right? We all know what that is? Sex is the biology. You're either one or the other. Gender is all the artifacts of social construction about what males do versus what females do. Those are social constructs. Same thing with race. I mean, you know, there's at a biological level some objective measure of skin color, but race is a social construction that springs from all of our underlying ideology. Dialogue is essential to it. Problem with dialogue is that most of us don't know how to listen. We know how to probe and ask questions, but most of the time we're probing and asking questions so that we can respond and correct the other person in their thinking. We rarely understand, or we rarely probe or listen for understanding. Another obstacle we have is with self-awareness bias. whole lot of reasons why that's the case. We tend to judge ourselves by our motives and intentions rather than the impact we have on others, contact with others, a whole host of strategies, things you can do to broach that subject. But last word is 30 seconds, I'll say. Consider creating your own counterculture. If you live in a broader cultural context, be it your corporation with a monolithic culture or the church or what have you, you know, culture, rules, policies, procedures tend to come from the top down. And for those of you here in Salt Lake, I'm sorry, it's probably going to be a lot more difficult for you to carve out a little counterculture in your niche of the church or the world. You know, living in St. Louis, it's a lot easier for me. I would suggest, if you're like me and you're just an assistant nursery leader, we'll carve out a little space of anti-racism in the nursery, right? If you're the gospel doctrine teacher and don't do anything to threaten them, they'll get you released, but carve out a little niche where you can there, or whatever corner of the world you have influence over, and I'll just leave it at that.
I'd like to thank you, Darren and Michael, for your presentation. Thank you all for coming, and we're out of time. I guess you'll have to ask your questions privately. Thank you very much. There will be tapes available, as you know.